This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Pioneer, Pure Vision, Insight, FedEx Orange, Motor City, AutoZone, and nothing rhymes with orange, meaning that I'll have to just toss in mentions of such delights as the always lovable Tostitos Fiesta and Meineke Car Care Bowls without benefit of verse. Dan Wetzel, who writes about college football for Yahoo Sports, joins me now from someplace bound to feature a bowl game any minute now. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
I can just sense your excitement, Bill.
It's that evident, I'm sure. Yeah. Let's take a moment to recognize the BCS.
Buzz me every week if I say it.
Well, Dan, the computers and the absent-minded pollsters finally got it right, and all of college football is rejoicing, right?
Well, there were only two undefeated teams, so sort of like a multiple-choice test with only one question.
Only one answer.
Or one answer, yeah. One question, one answer. Sorry. See, I couldn't even have gotten that right.
Are you with the BCS?
You couldn't blow this one. So we got two undefeated teams, Southern California, University of Texas. It's a no-brainer. They were 1-2 the whole year. They're still number one and number two, and it'll get settled in Pasadena.
Does the success of the BCS this year dash the hopes of fans who want to see a playoff at some point, or do they just figure this was a fluke and they still got to do something about the system?
I don't think it dashes it. I think it muffles the cries of this was broken and all the hollering because there's really nothing to complain about. But there's still no solution if there was more than one undefeated team, and that's just coincidence. Or if we say Texas had lost, we would have had a number of one-loss teams you're trying to fit in there. There's no system that properly determines which undefeated team should make it if there's more than two. So next year we'll go right back to having a controversy. Eventually the law of averages came. We're going to have this.
It's kind of like the blind pig finding an acorn every once in a while.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there are two undefeated teams are the two obvious ones you got to pick, but we still don't know whether they were the two best teams. College football has over 115 teams playing for one title, which is only college basketball, is more than that. And so there's really a disparity in the schedule. And three of the last 4 years, teams from the Big 12 Conference, which Texas represents this year, made the championship game and played very, very poorly. They really weren't deserving of getting in there. So I think this is going to be a good matchup. But if Texas lays an egg in the championship game, then maybe everyone could say we should have taken a one-loss Penn State team instead, or one of these other teams would have been better.
You think this is going to be a good matchup. That isn't exactly a ringing endorsement for number one against number two in the Rose Bowl on January 4th. Come on, isn't this going to be the classic everybody's hoping for?
We're hoping, but I got burnt last year when Oklahoma came in undefeated and played undefeated USC, and Oklahoma was terrible. And it was a product of a very weak league, the Big 12, and we just didn't know it until they had to really play someone. The fact of the matter is Texas beat the Ohio State Buckeyes in September, and they did not have to play another good team again. So they very easily ran up a record against a lot of weaker competition. I think this team looks good. They have a great quarterback. They have a great running attack. They have a lot of talent. They have a lot of speed. They have confidence they can match USC. But that said, until the game is done, if it's a bad blowout, you could look back and go, boy, we were fooled. It's very hard to judge these teams when nobody plays each other.
Before we get to talking about any more of the bowls, I want to point out that there are no games between college teams on January 1st. Why?
National Football League. Bill, you know it's a federal law that you have to watch the NFL.
That's why I'm on the run, my friend, and have been for years.
I know you slip off to Canada every Sunday, but January 1st is Sunday, and the NFL is not going to cede ground to anybody, and nobody wants to go up against the NFL in a ratings battle, particularly college football. So the games are pushed to January 2nd.
The other BCS bowls feature a rather retro lineup of traditional powers. Would it be better watching these games on the old wood-paneled Zenith with no remote?
Yeah, if you want to go old school on it, why not? You know, you could pop that out, maybe get two TVs next to each other so you can watch, you know, that was kind of old-style remote. We got Notre Dame, Ohio State, which is going to be a great game. Two Midwest schools and longtime rivals that don't always play each other. Florida State and Penn State is going to be a great game. Two winningest coaches of all time, Joe Paterno of Penn State. and Bobby Bowden, who is the winningest coach at Florida State. That's what you call old school. The idea that old guys can't get it done in college football or maybe in any pursuit is pretty much laid to rest with the Orange Bowl. The problem is they're playing the thing at 8 p.m., which means half of Boca Raton will already be asleep.
Of course, the bowl season is much more than the BCS. There will be 28 bowl spectaculars in the next 2 weeks or so. Which ones will you be sure to watch?
Well, once the Humanitarian Bowl went away because there was a bench-clearing brawl, I really haven't had a pure favorite. However, I think in terms of some excitement, Michigan and Nebraska are going to play at the Alamo Bowl in San Antonio, be kind of two traditional powers. I'll tell you a good one. The Sun Bowl down in El Paso features UCLA and Northwestern, both of which, that's I think the 30th of December, those two teams have both have great offenses and horrible defenses, which
Excellent.
Means could be a nice like 55-54 game.
My kind of game.
Why not?
And
2
which...
p.m. on December 30th. What else you doing?
I can't think of a thing. And which of the bowl games will you be absolutely sure to avoid?
Well, you know, the New Orleans Bowl, Arkansas State versus Southern Miss, that one's not exciting me a whole lot. Kansas and Houston in the Fort Worth Bowl doesn't kind of give me a whole lot of pause. But most of them, you know, it is what it is. It's the week after Christmas, and a lot of guys aren't working, people aren't working, or you turn on at night, and you never know quite what you're going to see. You see some teams that you don't normally see on TV during the season, and there's usually some wild shootouts and some crazy finishes, and everybody agrees there's too many bowls. Everyone agrees it's too commercialized. Everyone agrees it's crazy. But, you know, maybe Akron and Memphis are going to show us something in the Motor City Bowl. You just never know.
Dan Wetzel is a national columnist for Yahoo Sports, and he's our college football analyst. Dan, enjoy the bowls.
Hey, thanks. Always good to be on.
The remarkable number of bowl games about to transpire notwithstanding, not all the postseason college football spectaculars have proved to be spectacular, and numbers of them were short-lived. Actually, some defunct bowls were spectacular in curious and unintentional ways. Consider, for example, the Bacardi Bowl, which was also known as the Rumba Bowl or the Cigar Bowl. Havana, Cuba was home to the affair, which began in 1907 with a tilt in which LSU slipped by Havana University, 56-0. In the 1937 Bacardi Bowl, Auburn University played Villanova. David Housel, athletic director emeritus at Auburn, maintains that the experience was memorable.
Well, certainly when you have to practice football on a ship going from Miami to Havana, Cuba, that's kind of interesting. And Auburn did practice on the ship on the way down. In terms of the game itself, I remember some of the players talking about it being played on a hot, dry field and real dusty and the Cuban people not really knowing what was going on. And then Batista, the new dictator, came in and they stopped the game and everybody did something equivalent to today's Hail the Chief, but there were so many guns around. Some of our players said the most distinguishing part about the whole thing is the whole field was lined with gunmen.
In terms of U.S. sports history, the 1937 Bacardi Bowl is significant because two teams representing American universities had never before played each other in a foreign country. But Auburn's David Housel's favorite tales from the tussle in the tropics all involve Fulgencio Batista.
He overthrew the government of Cuba just a few days before the bowl game, and he almost called the thing off and wouldn't let them play because his picture wasn't in the program. Well, if you go back and look at that program there, just a one-page picture with nothing else, is His Excellency the Honorable this, that, and the other, Batista.
Less exotic than the Bacardi Bowl was the Oil Bowl. In 1946, Georgia knocked off Tulsa 20-6 in the initial Oil Bowl, which was also the next to last of the species. It was played in Houston. The following year, Georgia Tech beat St. Mary's 41-19. Brian O'Connor, the son of the man who quarterbacked St. Mary's that day, says his dad's team moved the ball better than folks thought they would against Tech.
Well, actually, the big problem with the game is they did outrush them. They had more total yards. They played heads up with them. However, they threw 8 interceptions and also 4 fumbles. 12 turnovers is tough to overcome.
The other big problem with that game, the one that might have accounted for the Oil Bowl's disappearance, according to Brian O'Connor, involved the halftime ceremonies.
They brought this oil derrick out, and all the cheerleaders and squads came up, and they hoisted this thing up, built this oil derrick, and then had some sort of a device that squirted a liquid, hopefully it wasn't oil, just like, you know, you'd struck pay dirt, and it's absolutely hilarious.
Among the other bowl games gone and mostly forgotten is the Junior Rose Bowl, which for a time pitted junior college champions against each other. Then it grew into an event featuring four-year schools and became the Pasadena Bowl. Ed Carpenter, the sports information director at Boston University, recalls that 36 years ago, it was a pretty big deal.
The statistics from our game against San Diego State, which actually they wound up winning 28-7, over 41,000 people showed up. And it was played in the Rose Bowl in Pasadena. It certainly was not second fiddle to any bowl. I think it was very well received. Why it went by the wayside, I'm not sure. But I do know that in 1969, when we played San Diego State, it was a very popular game.
Ed Carpenter's personal experience with bowls no longer roaring and rollicking with us is not limited to the Pasadena.
I remember before I came to Boston University, I was at the University of Delaware, and we played in the Boardwalk Bowl. Which was played in Convention Hall in Atlantic City. We also played in a bowl game when I was at Delaware back in the 50s. It was called the Refrigerator Bowl, and I believe it was played in Muncie, Indiana. And the Refrigerator Bowl princess was called Miss Refrigidorable. So maybe that was another reason why that bowl failed.
The lesson seems clear. If you want to start a college bowl that will endure, discourage firearms on the sidelines, don't allow the cheerleaders to erect a functioning oil derrick during halftime, play junior to no man's bowl, and abandon such accoutrements as Miss Refrigidorable in the planning stages.
How would you like to spend the weekend in Havana? How would you like to see the Caribbean shore? Come on and run away over Sunday to where the night and the music is tropical. You'll hurry back to your office on Monday, but you won't be the same anymore. How would you like to go where nights are so romantic, where stars are dancing rumbas in the sky? How would you like to spend a weekend in Havana? You better pack up all your summer clothes. Meet you down at Sloppy Joe's.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, cyclocross in the Providence snow. But first, next month in St. Louis, the best U.S. figure skaters will compete to determine which of them will travel to Turin for the Olympics in February. Among the female contenders is Emily Hughes, whom Jesse Green has profiled for tomorrow's Sunday New York Times Magazine. Jesse Green joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Jesse, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
Emily Hughes is 16, and she's still attending high school for at least part of the day. Is it fair to say that she has one of the more understanding high school principals of all time?
Yeah, I wish I had had that high school principal. He and the school have been through this before, of course, because Emily's older sister is the gold medal Olympian Sarah Hughes, mm-hmm. who also went to public school. This is extremely unusual for figure skaters, we should say, because the amount of training you need doesn't usually allow for any kind of normal life. But the Hugheses made a decision that they want their girls to have as normal an education as they possibly can. The principal at Great Neck North High School treats Emily as a kind of special ed student, he said. They create specialized curriculums for her. They let her out of certain classes. Obviously, phys ed is not a class she needs to take.
She gets that credit.
School.
That's all right.
She also gets the drama credit, and I think that's fair enough if you've ever seen figure skating. She gets a music credit. She knows, according to the principal, she knows more about classical music than any person at the high school except for the orchestra conductor.
Mm-hmm.
And then she takes normal, and I should say not just normal, but Regents level, honors level English and history and other courses like that and does quite well.
You write that Emily's mother can't bear to watch her daughter compete, but when you asked her father what it was like to see Emily fall while she was attempting a jump, he came up with a memorable response. Tell us about that.
Well, his response is based on his whole attitude toward the sport and really the whole family's. John Hughes himself was a very fine athlete. He was one of the captains of the hockey team at Cornell that was the only undefeated hockey team in the history of college hockey. They're a very hale family, you might say, and their attitude is very healthy about the sport. So his interest is in what the sport can do to make a healthy and solid person. And in that regard, when he sees his daughter fall, what he sees is a beautiful girl doing something beautiful. It doesn't phase him. That's not what he's in it for, and that's not what his kids are in it for. All the kids, and there are six of them, have been on ice since they were born, pretty much.
John Hughes also seems to have a healthy regard for what goes on in the lives of his skating children beyond the rink. That doesn't seem to me to be an attitude often encountered among parents of successful young athletes.
Well, it's a hard attitude to maintain. You can well understand why families that don't have a lot of resources put a tremendous amount of pressure on their little girls to make this happen, because if it does happen, the rewards are amazing. Millions and millions of dollars for an Olympic win in product endorsements and such. And the problem is that there's only one every 4 years, or at most, who reaches that level, and the odds are terrible. So a lot of families are pushing very hard in this way, and it doesn't work for them. The Hugheses have a different story. John is a tax attorney in New York. They don't live lavishly, but they're comfortable, and they've had the privilege of being able to raise their kids with an interest in these things, but without the pressure to make without the pressure that makes them the engine of the family's existence. And so the girls, in particular, all understood that they would do this, but they were going to college, and they were going to learn to love other things as well. Because, as John Hughes told them and told me many times, this ends. This is over at some point, and you had better know something. Most of the elite skaters don't, because they haven't really even been to high school, let alone college. They don't have the socialization that comes with that, let alone the skill training for a career or a way to learn to love something else. They end up on the ice tours or coaching. I don't mean to paint a terribly bleak picture of it, but the thing that the Hugheses have shown is that if you have a healthy attitude about this sport, and I would maintain other sports as well, and you see it in the context of a complete life, you can make the contradictions and the difficulties of the sport into something empowering, through which a little girl can grow into an understanding of who she can be as a woman, instead of as a trap that will destroy her, as it has destroyed many, most famously, of course, Tonya Harding.
Jesse, you mentioned the financing, and you discovered in the process of researching this article that bankrolling a top skater can cost as much as $130,000 a year, and that's if she doesn't make too many costume changes. How much of that expense gets underwritten by somebody other than mom and dad?
Well, very little. The U.S. figure skating has abandoned the distinction between amateur and professional and exchanged it for a distinction between eligible and ineligible. That is, they designate certain competitions as eligible for skaters who wish to still be considered for the Olympics. And if you are one of those at an elite level, they will subsidize you to some extent. That is, they pay for the skater and her coach to travel and for the hotel for a competition. And if you place high enough, you might make some money, although not a great deal. It doesn't really come close to making up for the cost of coaches. And it's not just one coach. You've got your spin coach and your jump coach, and you've got your choreographer, and you've got your Pilates instructor, and you've got your ballet instructor, and you've got your cardiovascular training and all the other things that come with it. Oh, and let us not forget the makeup and hair.
I referred to your article as a profile, but it's really a great deal more than that. At one point in the piece, you speculate on the attractions of figure skating, and you refer to, quote, little assassinations. What did you have in mind there?
Well, I'm very interested in the schadenfreude we feel when these beautiful girls fall and splat in the most ungainly way on the ice and are sort of still sitting there, shocked and spinning. You know, we claim to love this sport for the beauty of it, and yet we want to repress the fact that it is heavy-duty work. It's not feathers on the ice, you know. It's actually ice. It's hard. Emily says ice is hard and it's slippery. It's not pleasant. But from the fans' point of view, I think there's a strange thing going on with how we want them to fly, and yet secretly we're also kind of thrilled when that bam happens and they are left alone to face the consequences of the choices they made. And that drama is also, I think, what makes figure skating so interesting to so many people, and why it has risen above pretty much all of the other women's Olympic sports as the one that has the strongest fan base and beginning to have the strongest participation base.
Jesse Green wrote The Making of an Ice Princess for the Sunday New York Times Magazine that will be out tomorrow. He joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Jesse, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill.
A good cyclocross racer must master pedaling up hills, powering down straightaways, and slinging bikes over his or her shoulder to climb sets of stairs. When organizers planned last weekend's National Cyclocross Championships in Providence, Rhode Island, they knew the New England winter might add a degree of difficulty and fun. As only a game's Karen Given reports, they were right.
No doubt the kids who came to sled down the hills of Roger Williams Park in a foot of fresh snow last Saturday were surprised to find that the best slopes were already taken by brightly clad athletes on bicycles. Cyclocross racers revel in bad weather. Most of Friday's races were completed despite blinding snow, driving rain, and sideways sleet. Today, the bright sun and warmer temperatures have left the course a soupy mess, making it easy to tell which athletes have yet to ride and which have just come off the course. The latter have to be careful not to lick their lips, as every inch of their bodies drip with light brown mud.
In cyclocross, that's spot.
Hisham Magrawi was born in Morocco and raised in France and Quebec, and he's a lifelong fan of cyclocross.
You can go to a spa without paying for anything. Just come in and play. You see the kids, they're all like 7 and 8 years old, and they're all covered in mud, and their parents don't yell at them. It's funny. It's funny. It's just like it's beautiful sports.
If Magrawi has any trouble, it's in picking just one reason to love cyclocross. He loves that the sports superstars are approachable and friendly. He loves that cycling can help anyone stay in shape and enjoy the great outdoors. And he loves that even the day's youngest competitors have sponsors.
Cycling is one of the best sports to sponsor somebody because you see them going by, you can see your products going by. And it's cheap. You just give them socks and they will you get sponsored. You give them a bicycle and you can have contracts with them for 4 years or whatever. Cycling is still affordable for sponsorship.
Without sponsorship, cyclocross would be a prohibitively expensive sport. The national champions in the men's and women's elite classes will only get $300 for their efforts. The prize for 20th place barely covers the race entry fee. Marine Bruno Roy only received a jersey and a medal for winning the Masters women's race, but she says competing is still worth the effort.
Yeah, it's really fun. And if you see the conditions out there, people are sliding and slipping, and although this can be serious and competitive too, it's just got a little bit more of a fun feel to it, I think.
Bruno Roy is a massage therapist, so at least she gets to set her own schedule. She trains in the mornings, works until 8 or 9 at night, and travels to races every weekend between September and December. Like all cyclocross riders, she has to get creative when preparing for competition.
Yeah, a lot of your training has to be on the road. Local parks. A lot of times you ask permission, could me and my friends come and train at this park? And you sort of make your own courses.
Do you work in a couple running upstairs and stuff like
that?
Yeah,
that always helps too. The running part is something that a lot of cyclists don't do, and it really kills them.
This could be a very devastating blow for young Bjorn Sellander.
As the junior men's 17-18 race winds down, a duel between Bjorn Sellander and Daniel Summerhill comes to an abrupt end. As they slide down a steep hill, Sellander's derailleur snaps, leaving his bike useless. The accident happens right in front of the neutral support zone of mechanic John Berlinger. But because of the rules, he's not allowed to help. Sellander has to sling his bike over his shoulder and run around the course to the cyclocross version of NASCAR's pits. Berlinger has mud splattered on his face, too, and his fingers are no doubt sore from spending the day changing tires and tuning mud-encrusted bikes in the cold. But Berlinger says he and everyone else who made it out this weekend is having a good time.
Yesterday, when it was 50-mile-an-hour winds and the sleet was blowing, if you don't enjoy it, you don't stay. You get in your car and you go home, and you probably don't come back. There were folks who took them about 4.5 hours to get here from Boston, which on a normal day takes about an hour.
And they didn't turn around and go home?
Didn't even think about it.
Less than an hour before the start of the elite men's race, Ryan Trebone sits atop his stationary trainer, pedaling furiously while eating a Clif Bar.
Just getting warmed up, you know, getting the legs loosened up and everything. When it's this cold out, you know, it's really important. Especially the starts are so fast, you know, you really have to get properly warmed up, so it's not just a shock to the system.
Trebone spent the last month of this season racing in Europe, where cyclocross events are tougher and more competitive. Although the sport in this country has been steadily growing over the past decade, America's top cyclocross riders still have trouble breaking into the top 10 in Europe. But like the other elite riders here, Trebone manages to make his living on a bike.
Well, if I'm not, then I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah, I mean, especially in the U.S., it's a little harder. There's just not as much money involved. But in Europe, those guys are making pretty good money, so.
Today marks the end of the season in the U.S., but Trebone still has a few more chances to make his mark in Europe. No less determined, but definitely more laid back, is another of today's top riders, Adam Craig, who is just as likely to hop on his kayak as he is on his bike. That's if he bothers to train at all.
I went to Africa on this random trip a week and a half ago, and then have just been in Maine watching it snow and be really cold. I'm really well rested right now, as opposed to having been training a lot. I'm very fresh.
Craig's a veteran of cycling's more well-known events, mountain bike and road racing. But he says there's something special about cyclocross.
There's tons of people here, and it's super good energy just to have that. I mean, mountain bike, you're out, you know. World Cup courses are 3 or 4 miles long, so you're out for 20 or 30 minutes before everyone sees you again. So it's definitely nice when you're ripping around with cold hands, trying not to crash, to have people there yelling at you to keep giving her.
Though the first modern U.S. cyclocross championship was held in 1975, it was well into the 80s before more than 100 competitors participated. This weekend, 1,700 riders of all ages are registered to compete, and Craig is amazed by some of them.
I just saw these two little girls walking by, like, no leg warmers on, short sleeve jerseys and shorts, just, like, totally happy with their medals around their necks, and I was like, how are you so tough? You're a 10-year-old girl, and I have two pairs of gloves on right now.
He goes by the name of Tree Farm. He has won in Gloucester. Please welcome Ryan Trebone.
His mechanic, Mark Peterson.
The elite men finally make their way to the starting line for the premier and final race of the day. Spectators strain to get a look, while announcer and magazine publisher Richard Fries tries to bring the excitement up to the stratosphere.
And it's almost ready. He looks through his watch. He looks through his watch. That is the telltale sign. They are locked. They are loaded. Pull the cables loose. The rocket's about to fire here in Providence.
The race erupts in a cacophony as fans ring cowbells and sound plastic horns. From the starting line, riders can be seen winding their way through most of the 3.2-kilometer course. But spectators have taken positions at the most difficult and critical sections.
Now they go into the Jelly Belly Candy Bowl. Look at that.
The sponsors get their money's worth as the riders dip into the Jelly Belly Candy Bowl, jump over obstacles in the Harpoon Beer Garden, and ascend the Clif Bar run-up. Finally, after 8 laps and about an hour, the riders emerge from the Black Hills of Adidas, the only part of the race not visible to the crowd, with Ryan Trebone gaining on race leader Todd Wells.
Trebone is right there! Trebone is like 4 bike lengths off! Trebone is just 4 bike lengths off! Oh, the humanity! Trebone.
The sound of Wells crossing the finish line in first for the national championship is overpowered by even more cowbells and plastic horns. A spectator, also a rider, turns to me to say, "This race was epic." Richard Fries, who's been shouting superlatives into a microphone all weekend, has a little more perspective.
Well, epic was yesterday because my entire course blew down. It was like designed to destroy humanity yesterday.
Yeah, and then today is a breeze compared to that.
And we had great, great, great racing. Where, you know, it was real good fights and came down to the wire and the crowds were into it. So, yeah, it was great.
The day's best riders will have another chance for an epic race at the 2006 Cyclocross World Championships in Zedam, the Netherlands, in January. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Providence, Rhode Island.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at Cabot.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, have that special loved one drive Dan Weldon's Indy car out from under the Christmas tree. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Tension is mounting with regard to the inaugural World Baseball Classic. The Bush administration will not allow Cuba to participate in the games held in Puerto Rico. Why not?
Because the United States policy on Cuba, which is a relic of the Cold War, is one of the most monumentally stupid things ever devised by the hand of man. We are going to the Olympics in China the next time. A far greater threat and far more vibrant a totalitarian state than Cuba is, but because there are a few electoral votes in Florida, and because you've got a bunch of noisy people with more opinions and money and less sense than either one, the Cuban team can't come here and play. Now, there will be a Cuban team made up of Cuban-American big leaguers, but this is just, you know, we've been led around by the nose on this policy for far too long.
Meanwhile, Alex Rodriguez announced yesterday that he would not dishonor the U.S. by playing for the Dominican Republic and that he would not dishonor the Dominican Republic by playing for the U.S. Have you any idea what he's thinking?
Yes, he's auditioning for a role in a new movie, A Jerk with Two Countries. After thoughtful deliberations with my family, which I think can be fairly summed up by the phrase, yeah, right, he's not going to be at the World Baseball Classic, which will not be poorer for his absence.
Regarding money, almost any pro athlete could have said this week, I deserve every bit of it. But only one said, I deserve more than what they are asking back. Tell us of Tim Montgomery's hard times, Charlie.
Well, the one-time world record holder in 100 meters was suspended for 2 years for doping. And for the first time, he was suspended not because he'd failed a test, which he never has, and not because he admitted taking drugs, which he's denied, but on basis on the testimony of Kelly White in the Balco trial. And he's refusing to give back the money. They've wiped his name from the record books. This is an interesting and a very, very gray area in the whole doping thing. This is based on court testimony in the Balco suit and not based on any empirical evidence.
Pro athletes have to expect abuse from fans, sports writers, commentators, people like that. But I wonder if Eagles quarterback Donovan McNabb was surprised when his style on the field was criticized by the head of the Philadelphia NAACP.
Something about Donovan McNabb, and I don't know what it is, has made him a magnet for idiots. I mean, some people attract brilliance around them. Donovan McNabb, through no fault of his own, has become an absolute magnet for public morons. First it was Rush Limbaugh, then it was Terrell Owens, then it's this jamoke in Philadelphia who's decided that the best thing that he could do for the Eagles is start calling their gutsy and already maligned quarterback an Uncle Tom. This is, and the national office of the NAACP, of course, has already disowned the guy completely. But poor McNabb, you talk about not being able to win.
The Wall Street Journal reported recently that a new technology will soon enable gamblers to bet on every play pro football game. What does this mean to the football industry beyond the possibility that all of its clients will be broke by the end of the first quarter?
First of all, you're going to hear a lot of mysterious cheering. Outbreaks of wild applause or wild derision
from section
451 that are completely seem to be without foundation in the action below. This is not dissimilar to a story a friend of mine told me about playing basketball in the Philippines, where you are allowed to bet with the bookies on site on just about everything, including whether your American will beat the other team's American for most points in the fourth quarter. And as the guy said, one time we were up 50 and I had 4 points in the fourth quarter and a guy ran down to the sidelines and waved a knife at me. We're more genteel in this country, of course.
Each morning the sports page is filled with the names of basketball players who have scored more points than the whole Princeton University team scored when they played Monmouth this week. 21 points over the course of a whole game? What happened?
Well, let's not let Monmouth off the hook either. They only put up 41.
And they're 2-7.
Princeton, you know, became the poster child for deliberate, fundamentally sound, isn't it great to watch the back pick basketball. Okay, you can dial that up past 10, as we learned in Spinal Tap. 21 points is an embarrassment.
As you know, the draw for this summer's World Cup soccer tournament.
I've just recovered now from the excitement.
It occurred in Germany last week, and very shortly thereafter, the first cries of foul and conspiracy rang out. Do you side with Italian television or the German organizers on this one?
Remember the old story about the NBA gluing the envelope to the bottom of the bowl so the Knicks would get Patrick Ewing? This is even better.
It's better.
Lothar Matthaus, the captain of the West Germany's 1990 World Cup winning team, was accused on Italian television of rigging the draw. Some of the balls were hot and some of the balls were cold. And so he would know who he was picking, and that's how the United States wound up in the tough draw.
And finally, Charlie, if you had to pick a location for an attempt to set the record for the world's biggest snowball fight, would it be Brooklyn?
No, it wouldn't. It would no more be Brooklyn than it would be Tampa, but apparently they're going to try to do that. And believe it or not, as we all know, there is an existing record. 3 years ago, 2,473 people got together at a ski resort in Switzerland. So apparently Jonathan Rosen, a chemist from Cobble Hill in Brooklyn, is rounding up, I guess, 2,474 to throw snowballs at each other.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, among other fortunate publications, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
It is the time of year for the smoking bishop to flow, and the flaming rum punch as well, and the mulled wine, heavy on the cinnamon, light on the cloves, and be lively with you, good lad. Remarkable boy. It's also time for the 13th annual Only a Game Holiday Gift Guide. Yes, each year at this time, we offer this ghost of a chance for the increasingly desperate seekers of presents for the sports afflicted. And Louis Reske of Design Your Own offers you the opportunity to purchase and paint a bobblehead doll in the likeness of your favorite soccer player, male or female, or your favorite football player or cheerleader.
The nice feature on all our bobble figures is they have a double bobble, which is the head and the ball bobbles.
Ooh. These are the small...
They're about 9 inches tall.
9 inches tall. That's good, because the big life-size bobblehead dolls are scary.
Well, and you know what? It would take, like, gallons of paint, too. And you know what? It's not that we're opposed to it. It's just the shipping costs are high.
I can see this whole teams up there. Oh, give me a bigger brush.
Right. You know, then we would have to include scaffolding, and that would be tough.
Chipmunks roasting on an open fire. Hot sauce dripping from their toes.
Nothing says Christmas like scaffolding, unless it's a sports-related cookbook. They've appeared in our gift guides before, but never one with a dish connected to a $1 million payday. Race driver Bill Elliott once ate a meal at a South Carolina restaurant owned by Dale Barth, author of the Professional's Tailgating Cookbook. The following day, Elliott won $1 million at Darlington.
He came in and said, he just really felt like having some spaghetti. Well, we didn't have spaghetti on the menu, and he just came back in the kitchen. And he said, you know, Dale, he said, if you fix me a big old plate of spaghetti and meatballs, I think I can win that there $1 million. And sure enough, I figured out how to make him a big old plate of spaghetti and meatballs, and the next day he went out and won the race and won $1 million.
Hmm.
That was the magic of the spaghetti that did it. I mean, he didn't pay me but a couple bucks for the spaghetti, but he got $1 million.
When we tried the spaghetti sauce out on volunteers in the Only a Game kitchen, estimates on the $1 million spaghetti sauce ranged from $59.95 to a modest $500,000.
All my Goyim friends are making up their lists. And all my Goyim friends get some pretty sweet gifts. Like snowboards, cell phones, paintball guns, and iPods.
Apparel, the donning of which has a holiday ring to it, provides another splendid gift possibility.
My name is Sarah Schwimmer, and I'm the founder of ChosenCouture.com, and we sell a T-shirt. It's called the Juice for Jeter T-shirt. It's one of our biggest sellers. We like to joke that it's selling like latkes, not hotcakes, but latkes.
Yeah, of course, like latkes, absolutely. Now, why Jeter?
Why Jeter?
Sounds good with Jews, or...?
You know what? The designer was, you know, walking through the subway station one day, and she saw Jews for Jesus, handing out literature, and, you know, inspiration struck. She's she's a writer, and she also works for a Jewish summer camp, so it's just a great play on words.
Vicious, vindictive, and vengeful lacked the holiday ring, but our next gift possibility made the cut anyway. It comes courtesy of Turk Voodini Reagan, and it includes a cloth voodoo dummy, pins, and instructions for tormenting the teams you don't like. I asked him what would happen if I stuck a pin into the spot on the dummy marked Get Heckled.
Let's say there's a star player on the other team. Well, let's say his contract's up at the end of the year. You could start talking to him and saying things like, do you have any idea how much more money A-Rod is making than you? And, you know, best of all, if you can do it in the voice of Linda Blair in The Exorcist. Derek, do you have any idea how much more money A-Rod's making than you? I mean, that's going to throw him off.
Almost anything that has come from an old ballpark, preferably one that's been torn down and replaced by a high-rise or a parking lot, will bring a tear to the eye of the sentimental baseball fan. That's led Dr. Bill Hartell, who doubles as a dentist, to offer a line of pens made from the seats that used to grace various yards, including the former home of the current world champion, Chicago White Sox.
My dad was a contractor on the new Comiskey Park, and one day he went down to check out the job site, and they were hauling the lime green seats out of the old park to destroy them. So that was my Christmas gift in 1990, was a washing machine-sized box full of lime green smelly seats, with cigar smell and beer in it, and it sat in my garage for 12 years, not doing anything. And someone gave us a wooden pen last year for Christmas, and as soon as I saw the pen, a light bulb went off, ding, you know, and I realized what I was going to do with that wood.
I understand that you've got some quite notable customers on your list.
Well, George Steinbrenner has a Yankee pen. Now, I sent that to him last week. I never heard from him, but maybe I will, maybe
what a
I won't.
Surprise!
But we did have it engraved with his nickname, Boss, on the back.
Soon after I got off the phone with Dr. Hartell, I returned to my desk and found the following email in the Only a Game mailbox. Not 5 minutes after we spoke, it read, who should call but George Steinbrenner? Loves the pen. Wants a price on 100 or 2 for his closest friends. You could call him if you like at 81... Nah, I wouldn't do that this close to Christmas. Dr. Hartell was not the only purveyor of holiday delights who could drop the odd name on us.
This is Patty Grady, and the product that we're talking about is Classic Baseball Shortbread, which is produced by our company, the Cooperstown Cookie Company.
I understand that there are some baseball notables who have been very enthusiastic about your cookies.
Whitey Ford's granddaughter served 500 of our cookies at her wedding. which was a lot of fun. Craig Biggio's wife, Patty, went wild over the shortbread. So a lot of their friends are getting tins of cookies this Christmas. So we're in pretty good company. We're very excited about that.
We tried those baseball-shaped shortbreads out on several people here at the Only a Game Gift Testing and Tasting Center, and soon the cookies were all gone. Very soon. Golf is famous for gimmicks, and golfers are notorious for buying them. That may have been what inspired Chris Worley to develop the Putt-Her putter. The item appears to be a normal putter until you remove it from the bag, where it has been upside down, and turn it right side up, at which point there appears, slowly, the figure of a lithe young woman dressed for a season other than winter. We tried this item out in the testing center, too.
A beautiful putter. Look at that. Gorgeous. Sterling silver, could it be? Ebony handle, could it be? Oh, no. Oh, no. Ooh, this is good. My sister lives in Las Vegas. She'll love it.
Well, Santa's got a hot rod.
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 It's the only way he can rock and roll that old Christmas sleigh.
Each year, against our better judgment, we include a suggestion for the exceedingly wealthy giver, whose list contains a person who has everything.
My name is Ginger Reeder. I'm the Vice President of Public Relations for Neiman Marcus Direct. One of the gifts we're very excited about this year is the IndyCar Series Simulator, which is an exact replica of Dan Weldon's car. and you can sit in it and play a number of different IndyCar Series video games and pretend that you are about to win the Indianapolis 500.
This is an actual car, right?
It is an actual car minus an engine. I mean, essentially, you are playing the video game, but instead of sitting in an easy chair in front of the television, you're sitting in an actual Indy car. I mean, even if no one buys it, it's still, isn't it great? It makes you smile. You go, oh, now who in the world would buy that? Where would you put it?
For $22,000, or roughly one-third of the cost of that Indy car simulator, you can finance the construction of a school in Africa through World Vision, an organization that, for only $16, will send two soccer balls to kids who'd otherwise be kicking around rolled-up rags. Mike Lane explains.
World Vision is dedicated to building a better world for children, and one of the keys for any child, wherever he or she lives, is having an opportunity to play and have fun. A colleague of mine traveled to Rwanda, and literally a group of about 15 or 20 boys were doing cartwheels over the opportunity to play with one soccer ball.
I hope some of our suggestions will help, especially that last one. Happy holidays and good bounces to all from all of us here at Only a Game.
I wish you a merry, merry Christmas. I wish you a merry, merry, oh, I wish you a merry Christmas. I'd like to wish you a merry Christmas. I'd like to wish you a merry Christmas and a happy new year.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Manoli Weatherill at NPR's New York Bureau and from Greg Fazio and from the Only a Game Holiday Gift Testing Consortium. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about the gifts we included in this year's guide, and even some that weren't, like the Pittsburgh Steelers choo-choo train, the fishing lure toilet seat, and the golf ball sweet spot finder, or perhaps mascot mobile for your sports baby, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from native Philadelphian and sports fan voodoo kit marketer Turk Voudini Reagan.
In Philadelphia, we live under the curse of Santa Claus. He literally was routed from the field in a hail of garbage and snowballs.
It's no wonder Philadelphia hasn't won a pro sports championship in 22 years. You don't mess with the Kringle. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from Vision to Innovative Impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.